My mother is trapped in a virtuous circle. She gives things away all the time. If I come to visit her house, she's always giving cups and glasses and plates and money. And she says, you have to have traveling money. And you can't get out of her house without her giving you something. She's just always giving stuff away. Which is a good, really good thing, but it creates a problem. Because every time she does that, it's like the Lord blesses her generosity and she gets more stuff. And then she has to give more stuff away, which just compounds the problem, because then she's got to get that way away, and then she gets blessed even more from that. So I've been very blessed in having a great role model in my mother, because she is just generous to a fault. And she really embodies the idea from Ecclesiastes 11:1, which says, "Cast thy cares upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days." Just give it away. You don't know where it's going to go. You give some money to some orphans in India. You don't know how they're going to do after that. But you just trust that the Lord will bless those gifts that you give. My mother is just the opposite of the character that we see in... Actually, two characters that we see in today's readings. In Luke 12... verses 13 to 21. So if you'll grab the Pew Bible and turn to page 74 in the Pew Bible. It's Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21. So page 74, chapter 12, verse 13 is where we'll start. And we'll see how this person is not trapped into a virtuous circle because of their greed. So page 74, chapter 12, verse 13. I'm going to read through the whole thing first to just give you an idea what the whole thing looks like, and then we'll break it down verse by verse and give a few comments on each of them and then continue on. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he, Jesus, said to him, this interrupter, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, he, Jesus, said to the crowd, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly, and he thought to himself, the owner, "What should I do, for I have no place to store my crops?" Then the owner said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." So let's take a look at this a little bit closer. Verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Notice at the very beginning, it mentions crowd. So Jesus is already into his ministry, and the followers, the people following him, is growing. So there's some momentum there, right? Some momentum to the ministry. And somebody interrupts him and wants him to be an arbitrator between he and his brother. I assume this is probably the younger brother who is demanding more of the inheritance from the older brother. From the Old Testament, from Deuteronomy 21:17, the birthrights of the older one was that they got twice as much as the younger son would get. So the younger son is probably a little irritated here. "Hey, why does my brother get twice as much as I do? I want you, Jesus, to arbitrate between us and give me more of the inheritance." Notice that Jesus is responding to a request as far as the rhetorical situation here. He's ministering to the crowd, and all of a sudden somebody interrupts him, somebody asks him a question, and he responds to that. So that's the genesis of this passage. The person asks for arbitration. He assumes that Jesus is going to act as a rabbi. A rabbi would make wise decisions when two people are arguing with each other. However, the man doesn't really expect Jesus to be an arbitrator. Really, what he wants is for Jesus to be an advocate for his position and tell the older brother to give the younger brother more of the inheritance. So how often do we hear that? Somebody passes away, or there's going to be a rummage sale, and all of a sudden families are fighting over petty stuff, over stuff, right? How often do we hear families, or maybe ourselves, fighting over what is right? I just want what's mine. I just want it to be fair. But the problem is, there is no absolute fair. Let's say, for an example, that you have, well, I'll take my family's bag. And if my mother had to go into a nursing home, we would divide up the costs to send her there. But what's fair? Should it be the same dollar amount for each person? Well, that sounds fair. Or should we determine it by the percentage of people's income? Well, that would be fair, but that'd be very different than equal shares. Should we divide it by how much assets people have? That would be fair too. So the problem is, always expecting things to be exactly right is a never-ending process, because there is no absolute right. And, well, there is no absolute right. I'll leave it at that. The problem with this person from the crowd is that he's focusing on what he doesn't have instead of what he does have. And we're all guilty of that. I was guilty of that today. I have to focus and remind myself, well, you know what? There's 100 billion things that I don't have. I'm never going to have everything. I'm never going to have close. I'm always going to have a lot. There's always going to be a lot more things that I don't have than I do have. So I may as well just focus on what I do have. Let's take a look at verse 14. But Jesus said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" Jesus, in effect, refuses to act as an arbitrator. Fred Craddock, one of the commentators on this passage, quotes this. It says this: "Jesus is asked to be a referee, and he refuses. After all, who can judge whose greed is right? What if you have two people and they're both greedy? How do you decide between the two? Not only can you not come up with an absolute right answer, but how do you decide between two bad options?" And Jesus simply does what he often does. He says, "I'm not going to answer that question. I am going to raise the discussion to a higher level, up to those transcendent rules that I had mentioned last week." Always trying to take it up a notch and say, what are the general rules that we should go by in order to solve this disagreement? Verse 15. "And he said to them," Jesus said to the crowd, "take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Again, so this is the key, this is the transcendent rule. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Put a hedge around you. If you have a temptation that always is there, put a double hedge around you so that more things have to happen to you. An example would be, let's say I speed a lot, and I know that, the speeding limit is 35 miles an hour, and so I will tend to go 45 miles an hour. But if I have a single hedge of 35 miles an hour, I won't get a speeding ticket. But I'm so tempted to speed. I need another hedge around me. If it's 35 miles an hour, I better not go more than 30 miles an hour, because then I'll be really safe. Because if I crouch up to 35, I'll get so used to 35, I'll get it up to 40, and then 45 after that. So I'll put a double hedge around me. So as far as greed and temptations, a double hedge, a feeling of always being on guard, knowing what our weaknesses are, so that we can step back and say, what can I control? Everybody can control something. If I have temptations, what can I control? How can I step back to a point where I am in control? And that's the starting point of being on guard. Verse 16. Then Jesus tells them a parable. We have, like we had last week, we have an outer story and an inner story. We've got the person interrupting the crowd, and we've got characters in the parable. And the two are going to support each other. So, verse 16. He told them a parable. Sorry about that. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. I grew up on a potato farm. Big potato farm. When I was really young, we didn't have a lot of money. But my father was a very good potato farmer, and he did a lot of experimenting with how to grow potatoes to get a better harvest. It's hard work, and we would pray for rain. And I grew up in a Catholic church, and the local parish had a priest by the name of Father Hubert. Well, this is a farming community, so they had what's called a novena. How many people have been to novenas, a series of... these are nightly prayer services in which you pray for a specific gift. In this case, it's a farming community, so they're praying for a good harvest. I was very young, and 9 days in a row of church is really a grind. But now I can say, you know, that was really a good thing to do, because it kept the farmers focused on the true source of their abundance. Yeah, they're going to work, and they're going to water, and they're going to heal the potatoes. And at that time, we didn't have irrigation. Now they have irrigation. But at that novena, everybody was reminded that ultimately your blessings are from God. Somehow, our local priest took a novena and made it into 10 days. Novena is from the root of nine. And he thought, oh, we'll just add a little extra insurance in there. And we had 10 days instead of 9 days. Maybe it worked, because the farm did really well. And that farming community is still doing very well. The man in the story had a bountiful harvest. Notice that he probably did a lot of things necessary to grow that bountiful harvest, but ultimately he was not responsible for the produce that grew. Ultimately, only God can make a plant grow. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 6 to 7. Paul talks about developing the church, and he uses the language of farming. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. It's good to remind ourselves, we have to do our share. We have to work hard, we have to take care of our resources, but ultimately it's God that's going to bless the endeavors. Sometimes he's going to bless the endeavors, and sometimes he's not. And from the book of Job, you know that, you know what, his ways are way above us. We can ask, but sometimes the answer is no. We can ask, and we will always get an answer, and sometimes the answer is yes, yay, and sometimes the answer is no, but it's still an answer. James 1:17 says, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. So it's a nice thought to remind ourselves, every time we have a meal, to remind ourselves, we're blessed. We have food, and this ultimately comes from God. And what are we? We're stewards. We're managers. We don't own anything. God owns everything. And our job is simply to be good managers with what he gives us. And this rich farmer, he was rich already, and then he got more. He got a whole bunch more. But what did he do? He didn't keep his eyes on God as a supplier of that abundance. He started focusing on me, 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 I. So let's take a look at what the owner says to himself. Verse 17. And he thought to himself, what should I do? For I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. The rich man had a hunched back. All of a sudden, what's he doing? He's looking at himself. That's all he's doing, is looking at me. And his back is getting more hunched all the time, rather than looking up to God. So, keep our eyes on God, because he's the ultimate giver of our gifts. One of the commentators, last name Bach, says this: the rich man feels no concern or responsibility for anyone else. The essence of greed is keeping what resources God brings your way for yourself. So rather than keeping it all to ourselves, we shouldn't keep it all to ourselves. We should do something else. We should give some of it away. Verse 20. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? The irony is that the man is looking forward to a long, happy, leisurely life. He is resting on the fact that he's got all this wealth. And the irony is, he only has that night. He's going to die that night, and all this wealth that he was so excited about is going to go to somebody else. Fool is used. God said to him, you fool. In the Old Testament, a fool is one who refuses to listen to wise counsel. As a result, he does what is right in his own eyes, which inevitably leads to results that are harmful to himself. So as soon as we start demanding, I want to do it my way, well, do we really want to do it our way? Or should we step back and ask ourselves, well, what way does God want me to do it? Fred Kredek again says, he is a fool, says the parable. He lives completely for himself. He talks to himself. He plans for himself. He congratulates himself. And Daryl Bach says, in the Old Testament, fool describes someone who either acts without God or acts without wisdom in a self-destructive way. Fool is a very strong word in the Old Testament. If you call someone a fool, you're basically saying you are unwilling to learn. There's nothing I can do for you. I teach, and I'm fortunate because most of the students that I have want to learn something when they come to my class. But there are a few people that show up, and I keep thinking there's a certain growing age, it comes in the teenage years, all of a sudden, kids don't want to learn anything. We tell them stuff and they don't want to listen. And that would be a fool. If you are unwilling to listen to wisdom, you're being a fool. Kids are being a fool, or a student is being a fool. Fool is a very strong word to use against somebody. It's not really mean. You're just calling them out and saying, you are not going to learn. You are not going to learn God's ways if you don't open up your ears and your heart and your mind. If you shut it down, God's not going to bang through. He's going to let people decide for themselves if they're going to listen or not. Verse 21. We're almost done already. So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God. So here's Jesus finishing this parable. John Piper, the theologian, says, the treasures we should be storing up is time spent in the presence of God. The treasure, the real treasures, is time spent in the presence of God. If we spend time in God's presence, it will return an investment in our lives today in that we will be more content. We won't have the anxiety that so many Americans have, wanting to rush around and get more and more all the time and never having time to enjoy what they have. We have a front porch. I love my front porch. We bought a house last year, and Terry fixed it all up, and it's a nice opportunity to just relax and watch the world go by. And I love the porch. Thank you for that porch. So rather than chasing the next thing, we should be chasing God. And the nice thing about that is it gives us blessings today, and it also expands exponentially after we die. Because in this life, what have we been doing? We've been keeping our eyes on God. I want to be in God's presence. And after we die, we will be in God's presence all the time. So it's just a natural progression from blessings to overflowing blessings. Some lessons. Oh, that's right, I have some slides up there. Some lessons that I'm taking away from the reading and the studying that I've done this week. There's a Christian financial planner by the name of Larry Burkett. I used to read his stuff. How many people have heard of Larry Burkett? Oh, quite a few of you. He might still have a ministry in which he teaches people biblical principles of handling their money. And he does not beat around the bush. He says, talk is cheap. How you spend your money reveals what is really important to you. You want to know what's really important to you? Look at your checkbook, if you still have a checkbook. Look at what you spend it on. Look through the ledger. Talk is cheap. You want to know what's really important to you? Just look at the ledger and say, oh, look at where I spent my money. Yeah, I could come up with good lines about how generous I am, but what does it tell me about who I am and what my values are? How do I figure that out? He says, look at your checkbook, because the checkbook isn't going to lie. That's number one. What you spend your money on reveals what's important to you. Number two, the key to happiness is to be content with what you have. The rich man had all this abundant harvest, and he tore down his barns, and he brought all this grain in. That seemed wise enough, but he didn't have to do that. He could have given most of that produce away. He could have given all the produce away. He had so much. He was already rich. He didn't need any more. He wasn't content with what he had. And that's a lesson for us. Simply be content with what we have. It doesn't sound very American. We're supposed to go for more and more. And I think Weber is a, W-E-B-E-R, is a economist, or was an economist, that argued that the striving for the work ethic and the striving for more actually helps the economy. And that seems a bit unchristian to me. We need to be content with what we have. Next, be good stewards, managers of what God has given you. The purpose of being a good manager with your money is to put more money in the bank? No, it's to have more money that you can give to other people in need. So we are good, and I didn't even realize this until like last year. Oh, that's why I should be a good manager with what God gives me. It's not to come up with a certain amount in the bank for retirement. It is so that I can learn to live on less, and the extra that I have, I can give to somebody else. There is a Catholic priest and theologian by the name of Father Robert Barron, and he gives this example. He said, let's say you got money, and you're going to go and buy a nice car, and you really like this really nice car. But do you really need that really nice car? Let's say that car costs $70,000. Well, why don't you trade down a notch or two? You can get a really nice car for $35,000. Or how about $25,000? Why don't you trade down one step? it's completely un-American, but take one step down and take what you saved and give it away. You still got a new car. It's going to get you around really well, but now you've helped somebody else in the meantime. So Father Barron has some really great insights on the human virtues along with the human vices, and I like to listen to some of the things that he says. Father Barron on Catholicism, a great series on PBS called Catholicism. I highly recommend it. Tithing. The Bible talks about tithing, giving 10%. That's a good thing. But 10% of what? We've got to make these decisions. 10% of my gross income? Or do I give 10% of my after-tax income? I don't know what the right answer is. I've decided to go with the second one. 10% of after-tax income. And 10% of my money to go to the church, right? Or should it be 10% to the church plus charities? Well, we give our money 10% to the church plus charities, and just happens that a big chunk of the charity is the ministry in India. There's not a right answer, but the tithing, the 10%, gives us a goal to work for. And that brings me to the next one that's really important. It's okay to build up one's tithing slowly. We don't always hit 10% between church and charities, but at least it gives us a goal to work towards. When I went to church, an independent church in Fort Atkinson by the name of Faith Community Church, had a pastor by the name of Bill Bartz. And he would tell the story about how when he and his wife were younger, they were working towards trying to get up to 10% giving to the church. And one day, he comes home and he hears a scream, and he's like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And his wife said, "We did it! We did it! We finally did it!" That month, they were able to give 10% of their giving for the first time, and they were celebrating that, hey, we finally got our expenses under control and paid off some debt, and now we can give 10%. And they were joyous because they were able to give back to God and let God do whatever God's going to do with that 10%. And finally, Larry Burkett always told people, well, you don't have to stop at 10%. You can give more than 10%. I think you can only, I'm not an accountant, but at that time he said you could only deduct up to 50% of your income. If you gave more than that, you could not deduct. I don't know if it's still that way or not. But you can give as much as you want. You don't have to stop at 10%. Okay. Come down home stretch. Ask what God wants you to do with the financial blessings. You have some options. You can hoard them like the person in the parable. That's never a good idea. Why? Because it's focused on stuff and me, not God and other people. What's wrong with hoarding? Fred Kraduk again says, well, it's a form of idolatry. Placing your faith in wealth rather than God is not a good thing. It's self-centered. It shows disregard for the needs of other people. So you could hoard it. That's not a good option. You could hold them. You sense that you should give it away. God blesses you. You got the sense that you should give it away. But God has not yet revealed to you the person, project, or cause. So God gives me blessings. I'm just going to put it in the bank for now. I'm not going to spend it because I think God wants me to give it away, but I don't know what to give it away to. And inevitably, something will come up and you'll be, oh, that's what I should give it to. The next one, you can keep them. There's nothing wrong with keeping as part of our wealth to supply the needs of our family, needs for myself, the needs. It's good to remind ourselves, what are the needs? We need housing, we need food, we need clothing. In this area of the country, we need heat in the wintertime, and on a day like today, it would be kind of nice to have air conditioning. But we really just need to keep ourselves covered with buildings and clothes and keep some heat inside of us by food and outside of us with heat. My mother... I really was lucky. My mother is a very good role model. She always said, I just want jackets and boots and blankets for my kids. She didn't care about anything else. She would make blankets, and we would go to rummage sales for the coats. And the boots, who knows where those came from. With seven kids, you need a lot of blankets, a lot of jackets, a lot of boots. And that was a need, because this was Wisconsin, and she fulfilled it. And that's a good thing. It's prudent, it's wise to take care of your family members and yourself. So that's the third option. The last option is give them away. God has placed it in your heart to give the money to a specific person, project, or cause. Maybe this is the end of the second one, hold them. Long, long time ago, I was selling cookies and crackers for Keebler Company in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and I called on the Pick and Save there, and I'm stocking shelves. That's what you do when you sell for Keebler Company. And I'm walking, and I see a $5 bill. And I look around if anybody's, you know, digging in their pocket, and nobody was. And I'm like, I just made $5. I feel really good today. I put it in my pocket, and I went out, and I spent it. The same week, I'm back at the same store, doing the same thing. I'm stocking shelves. And guess what I found on the ground? Another $5 bill. And I'm like, this is weird. This is the second $5 bill that I found this week. And as soon as I picked up that $5 bill, the thought came to me, give it to the Gideons for Bibles. Why? Because I had stolen a Bible from the Gideons. I was going through a rough time in my life. Had my kids with me. We spent a night in a hotel, and there was a Gideon Bible there. King James Version, the real stuff. And I'm like, I took it. And I started reading it. And this thing is beat up. This is a work Bible. I probably read this thing 6 times. I got duct tape on this thing. It's been worn out so much. And you know what's cool? God supplied that Bible for me when I needed it. And he supplied the $5 to me so I could give money back to the Gideons so they could buy a couple more Bibles. They probably got another 2 or 3 Bibles for that $5. And it didn't even stop there. Once I gave my testimony to the Gideons, they recruited me to be a Gideon also. So I got some experience handing out Bibles. So the hounds of heaven, you never know how they're going to chase you down. I got that Bible, but boy, it cost me in a good way. Okay, so there's my story about watch out what you take. Be rich towards God, right at the end of this passage. Our real wealth is what we invest for eternity. Very succinctly, I stole this from Our Daily Bread in one of their passages. Our real wealth is what we invest for eternity. Chuck Swindoll always said, invest in things that are going to last forever. Invest in the Word of God. Spend time with God. Invest in people. It's very simple. Invest in the things that last forever. Not a whole lot of things last forever. People, God, the Word of God. That's what lasts forever.